Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. We're giving our panelists and our production team a couple of days off to enjoy a long holiday break. And so today we have a special edition of the show I think you'll find truly fascinating. My guest is Keyser Khan. Most of us first heard his name the night he gave a speech at the 2016 Democratic National Convention. His appearance coincided with a tribute the convention paid to his son, Humayun. He was killed in eastern Iraq during his first deployment as an Army Reserve officer.
Tonight, we are honored to stand here as parents of Captain Humayun Khan and as patriotic American Muslims. As patriotic American Muslims with undivided loyalty to our country. Like many immigrants, we came to this country empty-handed. We believed in American democracy, that with hard work and goodness of this country, we could share in and contribute to its blessings. We are blessed to raise our three sons in a nation where they were free to be themselves and follow their dreams. Our son, Humayun, had dreams too of being a military lawyer, but he put those dreams aside the day he sacrificed his life to save the lives of his fellow soldiers. If it was up to Donald Trump, he never would have been in America. Donald Trump, you're asking Americans to trust you with their future. Let me ask you, have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy.
It was a frankly partisan speech, but underlying the harsh attack on then-candidate Trump, TV viewers got a glimpse of a larger truth about Keyser Khan. He is deeply passionate about the ideals upon which America was founded. Now, Khan has written An American Family, a memoir of hope and sacrifice, a book that describes his personal journey. He's a native of Pakistan who came to this country like many immigrants do with few possessions or money. But now, he's a successful lawyer living in Virginia with his wife, Ghazala. As we began our conversation, I asked him to talk about his childhood in Pakistan. You tell us that your grandfather, back in Pakistan, when you were young, talked to you a lot about life. And one of the things that he quoted for you frequently that becomes a theme running throughout your book was a passage from Rumi, the great Persian poet, 13th, 14th century, I think.
Yes, sir.
So what if you're thirsty? Always be a river for everyone. What does that mean to you? What did it mean to you as a young boy, and how is it a thread through your life?
So that teaching of my grandfather, all the time, whenever there is a difficult moment, and when I feel a little darker outside, I think of that saying, and I have derived wisdom from it, corrections from it, whenever I have felt selfish, whenever I have felt totally empty of strength or courage, that sometime what matters in life is what you can do for others.
You essentially translate that in your book to your own words. Even if you're suffering, try to comfort others. Yes?
Of course. Of course.
So you grew up in Pakistan. You obviously did not come from a wealthy family, but you were able to get an education.
Yeah, it always had been. I remember the repeated emphasis by my grandfather that a person is not complete up until his or her education is complete. A lack of resources, yes, I have faced them every step of the way, but lack of resources had not deterred me from moving forward.
What kind of life did your grandfather have?
Well, he was a moderately educated person, well-read. He was a superintendent of railways in Indian subcontinent. Modest, humble person, decent, caring. So was my grandmother, very wise lady. And one story that I must share with your audience was that on holidays, on celebrations of holiday, Eid, Muslim holiday, it's a tradition to cook foods and share foods and eat and all that. When I was little, there were several occasions that we did not cook anything. And I used to wonder, I said, why we are not cooking? Everyone else is, and what would we be eating? So I asked them why we didn't cook last year and we are not cooking this year. So my blessed grandmother told me that this was their tradition. They divided what we had into several portions. As I said, we come from a very humble background. And your grandfather took and to neighbors, to others, and shared with those that did not have. So don't make a big deal out of it. So that had happened a few times in life as well, that they both preferred to share, regardless of knowing that we will not have anything to eat in the morning.
I don't think I'm being disrespectful, and please tell me if I am, if I point out to our listeners that as you told that story, it still brings great emotion to you.
Oh, yes.
That was many years ago.
Yeah. I'm 67. That was when I was 10-year, 9-year, 8-year old. I have the memories of those moments. And so it had amazingly powerful imprint on my heart and on my soul that I feel the sense of it even today.
So what if you're thirsty? Always be a river for everyone.
Yes.
As I read your book, one of the moments that was striking for me, and because it was for you, was to deal with the moment in which you discovered the American Declaration of Independence. Where did that happen? How old were you?
1972. Yes, 1972. I was 22 years old, second-year law student, and I had taken a course titled Comparative Study of World Constitutions. The materials were unbound, I brought from the bookseller and placed it on the metal desk in my dorm room in Lahore. And by accident, my sight went to the top page, and the very first page had the line on top of it, boldly written, said, Declaration of Independence. I said, wait a minute. I had lived in the community of subcontinent where declaration is given when the benevolent king feels that he cannot or she cannot extract any more from the colonized people. They will give you independence and you struggle for it, you appeal for it, you protest for it. But what are these people? They are declaring their independence. I was in awe, and I read the entire Declaration of Independence, half understanding, because it is in little difficult English, and especially for me then, with the sense and the spirit that I got from it. I said, oh my God, this nation had figured it out in 1776. We have waited, the rest of the colonized world had waited till late 1900, 1950, 1947, when subcontinent gained its freedom. What an exceptional people these must be. So my love affair started in 1972.
I like the fact that you kind of describe the language in the Declaration as aggressive. It's very bold. We hold these truths to be self-evident. And you say, well, that didn't seem self-evident to much of the world.
Yeah, it's self-evident, maybe inalienable. Maybe I say that to my American friends. Please read these words yet one more time. We are under a difficult moment in our history. The whole democratic system is, but these are not self-executory. We make them self-executory. We make them executory, meaning we stand for them. If anyone violates, we run to the courthouse and we make sure that these remain inalienable. And I call these dignities, these privileges and rights that are listed in our documents, these are human dignities. Every human being wishes to have those dignities, and we are so blessed that we have them. And these are very powerful ideals.
Do you mind if I read just a tiny bit of your book? I read the Declaration of Independence over and over and over in my room until the shaft of light had thinned, crawled up the wall, faded completely. I was fascinated, enthralled, as if words from 200 years earlier had wrestled some sleeping part of me awake. And you immediately, in the next day or so, go to your friend Farouk, and you say to him, have you heard about what happened? How the United States became a country. I wanted to go back to that because you were completely captivated first by the Declaration, and then you discovered the Constitution.
Yes. All 1,338 words of Declaration of Independence. Some I understood, some I did not at that time. So Farouk was my friend who was doing his postgraduate studies in English literature. I went to him, I said, let's read this. Have you read this? He had not read it. And so we read it together, and he tried to explain to me some of the terms and some of the diction of the way Declaration is written. And the more we read it, this is taking place in 1972, on the green grass under the shadows of the trees of the Punjab in Pakistan, in central Pakistan, and we're sitting there on the grass and reading it, and amazed at the spirit of the sentiments that are expressed in the Declaration. Amazing, amazingly powerful document. So after declaring our independence, the connection, articles describe how we will govern ourselves, how these civilized people that have the courage to declare their independence are going to live by. These are the rules and regulations, the separation of power, the judicial system, the court system, the assemblies, the state and federal relation, all enumerated in a way that's how civilized people live, by rule of law.
Now we're in the Constitution, of course.
Rule of law, exactly. And then came the best part, the dignities that are enshrined in our Bill of Rights. And I am still in awe of the first five words of the First Amendment. And I implore your audience, and I implore America, to reread your documents. Reread the First Amendment and five first words of the First Amendment.
Those words are, Congress shall make no law. What do those words mean to you, and why are they so important?
Oh, they are so very important. No other nation has in their constitution which says the Supreme Assembly, the legislative authority of the nation, the Congress, the parliament, the legislative body, they all say has the authority to do this, has the right to do this, has the right to enact laws, except when we get to this blessed land where it says Congress shall make no laws. Meaning is that the dignities that are enshrined in our First Amendment and thereafter all other amendments, Congress will have no authority to touch those dignities that are enshrined. Among them is the freedom of press. The most, and it, I was so taken when I read that, because my background, early childhood, and thereafter, I have lived under martial law, under authoritarian dictators, military leaders, those who considered themselves authoritarian. They decide, they know best what is good for these people on the streets. I will decide what will be, what rights they will have, what rights they will not have. Then to come and read the First Amendment and its first five words, that even the supreme legislative body of this nation is prohibited to touch those sacred rights, press. And it is, today's environment is so telling of the authoritarian mentality, and I am so so sensitive about that, because twice in my life I have lived under those circumstances, and God forbid that we don't face that type of environment. We are almost close to that type of environment, where I've seen with my own eyes that the newspaper printing presses, their offices, their buildings would be burnt by the dictator. They're bad people. They misguide the nation. They mislead the people. They don't tell truth. They make up facts and they publish. Turn them off. Let's arrest all of the newspaper writers and reporters and those who do not stop. Let's shoot them. I have seen with my own eyes newspaper reporters being shot, injured, beaten during two martial laws. Mm. And this is not only in Pakistan. And look at the wisdom of our forefathers, the very first dignity they bestowed upon this nation. And I implore, when these people say fake media and they malign the press, they malign the media, I ask them to read it one more time. That is the most, that is the, maligning the free press is the symbol of authoritarian mentality.
It strikes me, as I've read your book, you are a very romantic spirit. Where I'm going with that is, one of the things I loved reading about was your courtship of the woman who became your wife. You met her in college. And people can read the book and they'll see how difficult it is to conduct a courtship in Pakistan in those days. What year would that have been?
Yeah, I couldn't simply just go up to her and say hi.
I was so struck by you. Ghazala turned 21, and you wanted to find the perfect present for her. What did you get her for her 21st birthday? Yeah.
I couldn't afford anything. I was a person without any resource, without much money. So I had to come up with some nifty idea that she had all the resources. She came from wonderfully resourceful family, well-to-do family. They had everything that a person needs in life and more. And here I was, not much money in my pocket to even feed myself, and but I had to present her something that would be worth the dignity and the care that I had and I have in my heart for her. So I go to Tollington Market in Lahore, and I bought her the present that I could afford. So those were 21 sparrows that I could afford. And I had written on the card that, release them tomorrow morning. And when you release them, you will receive the blessings that the freedom of these birds will reflect. And so she, the word got around throughout her dormitory, and everybody was gathered at her door next morning. They wanted to participate in that. So I didn't design that. It just so happened to be to participate in that releasing of these 21 sparrows at her 21st birthday in the wild And so they all stood there with, I don't know what prayers they had in their hearts and all, but they all told Ghazala that that this is an exceptional gift out of having no resource, such a meaningful gift.
And you have not looked back since. You two have been married for 41 years at this point. You know, no one has to tell you that we're living in a time now when there's great controversy about any immigrants in this country, legal or illegal, right now. And your story tells us a lot about what the immigrant experience can be like. When you first came to the United States, you had to work two jobs. You taught at a little college in Texas, Houston, and for $3.50 an hour for a 40-hour week, and the only way you could survive and eventually bring Ghazala here was you worked overnight as a security guard, essentially, right? I mean, this is what an immigrant experience not unlike what many still have today.
Well, that is the spirit of immigration. Immigrants want to make their life better, and they wind up as a result, their family's life better and their community's life better, their community at large's life better, their nation's life better. And that is the spirit of immigration. And this is a story, the names could be changed, and this is a story of every immigrant. I was in New York a couple of nights ago, and several of the audience came and said, "This is our story. This is our family's story. That is how we came, empty-handed." So it's the story of immigration. It's a story of immigrant to make life better, not for yourself, but for all others that are around us. That experience of becoming citizen is still so fresh in my heart. And I am about to go into the courthouse, and I remembered all the indignities, how I felt when I couldn't step outside the house without the permission, without the fear of being shot. I am about to enter the courthouse to become a citizen. I take the oath of citizenship, among others, and I'm given a certificate. And that certificate says on top of it, Certificate of Citizenship of the United States of America. And I look at it. Those lines, my eyes welled. In my conscience and in my soul read to me, Certificate of Human Dignity. And I walked out. My God, all those dignities that I have read on pieces of paper, today I have them. Today those dignities are guaranteed to me. And I implore America, I implore your audience that read them one more time. The reason for this reminder is this. Captain Humayun Khan wrote an article, the title of that article, it is so relevant today. Democracy requires vigilance and sacrifice. The more vigilant we are of these dignities that are enshrined in our documents, our ideals, our ideal of democracy, self-governing, rule of law, our constitutional rights, these are all under attack. These require vigilance from us so that we protect them and we make them stronger.
Can we talk about your son?
Sure, sure. He was, as I said, he was a replica of Ghazala in every which way, kindness, thoughtfulness, strong, brave, total replica of Ghazala. He was 5 years old. We got a call from, he was in fifth grade, not 5 years, fifth grade. We got a call from the principal's office. And Ghazala got worried. I was at work. She called me. She said, "Principal called, and they want to talk about something about him." And I said, "Please run if he must have done something wrong. Normally, they don't call." So she got to the principal's office and very worried that Humayun could not have done anything wrong. So she sees Humayun, a girl and a boy, and their teacher sitting in principal's office, and the principal says, Mrs. Khan, you looked worried. Don't worry, there is nothing bad. Something good has happened. And principal describes that this boy had been bullying this girl for so many days, and she would cry every time, and teacher would tell the boy not to do this. But today what Humayun did was so brave, was so exceptional that we wanted him to see that I am telling you this as his principal, that he stood up to the boy today when he was bullying her, and he said, you will not do this again. And so that was Humayun.
It was that same impulse that led him to decide first to join ROTC when he was in school. Neither you nor Ghazala were thrilled that he wanted to do that. You began to worry from that moment on about a possible career in the military, I think.
Yeah, he had plans, as all parents do, and we discussed with him that he wanted to finish the college and then go to law school and then probably practice law. Because other two sons, they were more inclined towards science, and they both are scientists, and they do their own medical research and all. But anyway, Captain Humayun Khan, when he decided that, he told us that he's wanting to join Army ROTC, and we were concerned because my question was to him, very first question, that what about your law school, what about your postgraduate studies? He said, I will do that after I complete my training and my commitment that I'll make. And we were concerned, and I told him this, that whenever you join large organizations, they take over your life. They decide what you do, where you work, when you sleep, when you eat, and the whole control of your life is taken over by them. He said, no, this is what I definitely want to do, because whenever I am with the cadets, whenever they're around, they're so honorable people. They look after one another. They are so hardworking. They are so mission-oriented, and I feel that I am in my element when I'm with them. So which parent would resist when your grown-up child is saying that because of these qualities, I wish to join them? So he joined, and he served.
He went to Iraq. What was the date of the incident in which he died?
This was... that fateful day was June 8, Tuesday, 8 o'clock in the morning, 2004.
He behaved bravely in that moment, in the same way that as a fifth grader he had stood up for a young girl. He now took an action that he believed would protect his own men. Are you comfortable telling us what he did that
sure,
day?
Sure. I was just recently, I was in Washington, D.C. at an event in a synagogue. A lady approached me with a picture of Humayun and her in uniform. She said, Mr. Khan, I was under Captain Khan's command. And I hugged her, and she said, he had promised me. I used to worry when I was deployed to Iraq with him. And he used to very quietly tell me that, don't worry, I'll take care of you. And she said, I was there. And that is what his commanders also told us. And now many have come forward that were there on that fateful day. He was due to come to duty at noon. They worked in 12-hour shift. He was responsible for the safety and well-being of the people in the camp in Bakuba, Iraq. That morning, he got up and he came, because 8 o'clock in the morning, there is a change of people leaving after breakfast, American soldiers for the day's mission, and then local Muslim Iraqis are coming in to do the camp's work and provide services and all of that. So there is crowd at the gate, and he got there at 8 o'clock in the morning, making sure that transition is taking place smoothly. He sees a very fast coming car, his soldiers are all stationed properly, and we are told that he must have realized the danger that was headed his way, very fast coming car towards the gates of the camp. And he had several choices. One choice, we are told, was that shoot the car, but that wasn't his way of thinking.
He was afraid there might be innocent civilians
person inside.
Who had lost their way.
Yeah. And so he shouts very loudly, hit the ground, and he orders his men and women to hit the ground. So did everyone else when they saw the soldiers went down, and he moved forward. We are told that he took approximately 10 steps with his hand extended, trying to stop that fast moving car towards the gates, and he caused them to prematurely detonate that fast-moving car. And that day, only one American soldier died, and that was Captain Humayun Khan. He saved. Many others were injured because of other things, but everyone was saved. And we're proud of him that he was faithful to the oath of office that he took, that he will care for others, and he will protect America, and he will protect Americans. And as a result, he winded up protecting many others that were at the gate. Among them were Muslims. And we receive pictures and photos even today from the retired soldiers and their families. We receive pictures from Iraq, those Iraqis that were at the door, sending us the pictures of their growing family with a note that we always think of him. That if it wasn't for his sacrifice, we would have not been able to raise our families. Here are our sons and daughters sitting at a Thanksgiving table or at a Christmas event, or from Iraq on the day of ending of the Ramadan. And so life had not been same for us. He had blessed us for 27 years.
Much of your book is a tribute to him, but there's one line particularly that is deeply moving, your tribute to him. And I want to make sure I pronounce his whole name correctly, so you'll work with me on this. Humayun Saqib Muzam Khan.
Correct.
A most fortunate one, destined for greatness, a king who would shine among the heavens. He was, and I believe he does. I don't think in a sad situation as this, a child could ask for a parent to say something as eloquent and deeply moving as that is. That's a remarkable sentence, Mr. Khan.
Well, thank you. I wanted to mention this, that some good continues to come out of all of this. The proceeds of this book are dedicated to the scholarship that we have set up at University of Virginia. The title is Captain Humayun Khan Memorial Scholarship. In perpetuity, it has been funded, will be given to a person, a student at the University of Virginia, on need-based. So some good continues to come out. As Ghazala says, when people ask her her sentiments and her thoughts, she said, who says he has left us? It's our inability that we are not able to see him physically. But he's always with us, and he's always there. And look at the candle that he lit, candle of care for others, to your own peril. From that candle, the rest of the world continues to light their candles. So we were blessed to have him for 27 years.
As we move toward your convention speech, there was an event that was occurring in your house after his death that had a big played a big part in what you eventually did at the convention. His superior officers began sending young cadets to visit your home, to hear your son's story, to hear Ghazala and you talk about him, to inspire them, to help them understand the importance of what they were doing. And I know those became very meaningful events for you. you wanted to figure out what you might be able to present to these young soldiers as a keepsake, a remembrance of that visit. What did you end up doing?
Yeah. I used to, initially, when they would come to pay tribute, to visit us, to hearten us, to show their respect, we would present them Senator McCain's book, Why Courage Matters. But that became an expensive deal for me because the book was costing about $20 each. And these would be 10 cadets, 20 cadets, sometimes 25 cadets, and I would present to them. So later on, we decided that that's an expensive arrangement. So I was renewing my American Bar membership. I looked at their website, and there was Pocket Constitution of United States, Pocket Size Constitution of United States, 99 cents. So I said, this is something that will be more appropriate to the occasion. So I ordered multiple, and even today we have several that we keep the supply updated. And I started to present to them with this humble advice that, please read the Constitution. You're about to take an oath to defend it. And we receive letters after receiving the Constitution upon that visit that this is first time that we have received a copy of the Constitution to which we will be taking oath in next month or next year or in near future. We have taken courses in civics and in college, political science and all that, but we have never read the Constitution in this form where all three documents are listed. So it became very meaningful. Plus, some of them would write that this was the first time they have come to visit a Muslim home. And it looks like our own home. It looks like our parents' home, our grandparents' home. What an amazingly positive, wonderful experience. After the convention, we received thousands and thousands and thousands of letters and cards of encouragement. Thank you for reminding. What a wonderful moment that was in this. And then came a 26-page letter written by a retired Army nurse. In 25 pages, she writes that I have served in United States Army as a nurse in Second World War in Germany. And she says on the 26th page, and I never forget that because that is what keeps me going. And it says, Mr. and Mrs. Khan, continue to speak. Had more people spoken before Second World War, the atrocities that were committed against the mankind could have been avoided. Atrocities that were committed against our Jewish brothers and sisters could have been avoided. Not very many people spoke, so please continue to speak. I never forget that 26th page. I always remember this. So it was that was taking place, that we were giving Constitution to our cadets, and we will have conversation with our guests as well. Whenever people would come, and we will talk about Muslims and Constitution and American values and all. So similar, the lessons, the teachings are so similar, uplifting of human being.
The convention was not an easy decision for you to make. In fact, you say even at the beginning of this book that you consider yourself to be a very private person and that it was hard to write some of the things in this book that you did. But the convention itself, when the Clinton campaign asked you to do it, you at first turned them down because you thought you didn't want to expose yourself and Ghazala, the memory of your son even, to the possibility of criticism afterward. But something changed your mind.
Yeah. After that bigoted statement, I'll ban all Muslims, all Hispanics will be thrown out,
from
women
Trump.
Are not of equal dignity, and judges are partial, made by the then candidate Trump. Small children would reach out to us and would ask, you're a lawyer, is this possible? But we were born here. These are elementary and middle school kids asking me these questions. through their parents sometime and sometime directly, and I would hearten them. I would read the 14th Amendment Section 1 to them. We are all equal citizens under due process, rule of law, equal protection, and they were not being heartened. So when this invitation came to pay tribute to Captain Humayun Khan, we agreed to that part, but then they said we are inviting other Gold Star families as well. After the tribute to their loved one, they are speaking. Would you come? I told them, can I think about it? And I called my other children, and they told us, do not go. Your reputation, your peace, your privacy, your character, everything will be maligned, because that is what takes place in such political events. Same thing, I thought maybe they are being overprotective of us. I called several of our well-wishers, more acquainted with the political activities, and they told us exactly the same thing, do not go. So we almost made the decision that we will not go. Second day, I went to check the mail. There was a white envelope with a card inside, no stamps, so somebody must have come to the mailbox and left it there, and I opened it out of curiosity, right, standing at the mailbox. And I recognized the name of the school because I had hugged these kids and I've asked them, which school you go to, what grade you are in. These were four kids that have written that card to us, and this is the line that sent us there. And the line said, Mr. and Mrs. Khan, would you please make sure that Maria is not thrown out of this country? We love her. She's our friend. I brought that card immediately to Ghazala. Said, remember, we had been sitting in Himayu's room and we had been praying that some guidance, everybody is telling us, do not go. We have heard from these children. How would we face them if we told them that we decided we will not go? How could we speak on their behalf so that they are heartened? Ghazala looked at the card, looked at me with her eyes well. She said, this is the message that we were waiting for. We must go.
Candidate Trump made much of the fact that Ghazala stood by your side silently that night. What we learn in your book is that she was incredibly active as a partner in writing the two-minute speech that you were granted time to give that night. So it must have been somewhat difficult for you in the aftermath to hear him insult your wife, and suggest that this was an example of Muslim women being subservient, not having their own voices.
I was troubled and bothered that this was yet another display of ignorance. And person seeking the highest office of this blessed nation yet displays ignorance, yes, yet displays lack of empathy. Meaning that Ghazala, I asked Ghazala when we were traveling, when I was writing this, that you must speak, you must say something. And she would, every time I would ask her, she would say, you know that I'll fall apart. And that will be most indignified moment if I fell apart on the podium at this stage. So she told me that, no, don't insist. And so the first line, it is interesting that I must tell you, she took her pen and she deleted that when I was writing that speech. This was the first line of it, which Ghazala removed it immediately. These are my words. I have not plagiarized from Mrs. Obama.
So making fun of Melania,
exactly,
Trump,
exactly,
for her
plagiarizing
her
speech. She took the pen. She said, no, you're not going to say this.
Caliber, she was right,
caliber,
wasn't she?
Caliber. And then she wrote an op-ed page telling that only a parent would know how to feel who has lost a child under these circumstances, and that the difficulty that she has had speaking, especially when her son's picture is on display.
How are you both today, having gone through this whirlwind during the campaign?
We're fine. We're moving forward with life. Good continues to come out of that sacrifice, of that display of care for others, serving the nation. University has honored him. The nation honors his sacrifice. Not only I always say this, I wear this gold star pin on my lapel of the coat, not because I am Humayun's father, but because on behalf of all men and women that have served and have sacrificed. It's nobody wishes to wear this. I wear it with honor and with this love and respect that I have towards all men and women that have sacrificed their life. So good continues to come out. We are moving forward, and life is under these circumstances. It is a bit hectic, concerning for the well-being of our nation. But with this message of hope that under these circumstances, nations have come together. As I come from Virginia, and Virginia has shown that there is solution to this difficult moment in our history.
Your elections, beginning of November,
coming together, standing up for democracy, standing up for our values and our way of life, and we will prevail. Majority of America feels that way. I have traveled to 168 communities since last August, and majority of the nation is concerned. With that concern, they promised to themselves that we will play our part. We will participate in our elections, in our election of better leaders, so that we remain beacon of hope for the rest of the world.
As we close, your love for this country shines through in virtually every page of this book. I think one of the most moving passages, you talk about the fact that if you were to take the Bill of Rights to the farthest edge of the world, where no one has even heard of the United States, and you read it, you say, ask people if they want to have the right to speak freely, to worship freely, and they will say yes. Ask them if they want to be free from the police rousting them from their homes for no good reason, and they will say yes. Ask them if they want to be able to protect themselves. Ask them if they think the law should treat everyone the same, and they will say yes. Those are the First, Fourth, Second, and 14th Amendments. And everywhere in the world, people will want those things. An American Family, A Memoir of Hope and Sacrifice is your book, and it was a real pleasure to have you here to talk about it today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you'd like to watch Keyser Khan's Democratic Convention speech, we've put a link to it on our website at gpbnews.org. Just click on Programs and then find Political Rewind. You'll also find information about his book there, too. As we move quickly toward the end of 2017, we're wondering, what do you think have been the biggest political stories of the year? On the national level, was it the GOP's inability to get rid of Obamacare? Or was it their major tax bill victory last week? Is it the Robert Mueller investigation of possible collusion between the Russians and the Trump campaign? Or is it something else entirely? And what about here in Georgia? Was it the 6th District congressional race between Karen Handel and John Ossoff? It became a big national story and was the most expensive congressional race in history. Was it the infrastructure problems and the way in which public officials responded to them? The shutdown of I-85, the power blackout at Hartsfield-Jackson Airport? Or do you have a different story in mind? On Friday's Political Rewind, our panel will offer their top 10 political stories of the year, but we'd like to hear your choices too. Tweet them to us at PoliticsGPB. That's all the time we have for today. Our producer is Tom Faust. Our associate producer is Olivia Rheingold. Tyler Morris is our engineer. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for being with us today. See you again for another Political Rewind Friday at 3:00.